The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Before we start today's podcast, I want to tell you about a new exciting program called Rewire You. It's Second City's take on professional development, using the skills of improvisation to navigate an ever-complex and challenging business world with greater authenticity and resilience. More importantly, we have partnered with the Chicago Booth School at the University of Chicago to infuse the program with cutting-edge research from the world of behavioral science. Rewire You is great for current and future leaders who want to get more from themselves and their teams. You can find out more at secondcity.com/rewireu. Classes begin soon. Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and in your life. Yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey,
my guest today on Getting to Yes And is Adam Grant. Adam is Wharton's youngest full professor and single highest rated teacher. He is the author of Give and Take, a New York Times bestseller that has been translated into 24 languages. His speaking and consulting clients include Google, the NFL, Apple, Facebook, the U.S. Army, and Pixar. Wow. His current bestselling book is called Originals, How Nonconformists Move the World. Adam, welcome to Getting the Yes And.
Thanks, Kelly.
So I first met you around 3 or 4 years ago when you came by the offices at Second City to have a conversation with myself and Tom Yorton, the guy I co-wrote the book Yes And with. And here's the amazing thing I've learned about Adam Grant in these last few years. He not only believes what he writes about, but he works really hard to model his own actions on those beliefs, which is entirely rare in my experience. Specifically, Adam is a giver. And as he wrote in his book, Give and Take, and I'm going to quote the book here, if you're a giver, you might use a different cost-benefit analysis. You help whenever the benefits to others exceed the personal costs. Alternatively, you might not think about the personal costs at all, helping others without expecting anything in return. If you're a giver at work, you simply strive to be generous in sharing your time, energy, knowledge, skills, ideas, and connections with other people who can benefit from them. So, Adam Grant, were you a giver before you wrote the book, or did you become a giver after writing Give and Take?
Oh, hold on. Back up a step. Who says I'm a giver?
My experience is you are a giver.
Well, it's kind of you to say. It's honestly not my place to judge, right? Mm-hmm. I can say that I aspire to be a giver. I chose of all the topics I could study, I chose this because these values are really near and dear to me. But whether I succeed in living by them is ultimately in the eye of the beholder. And I think that in some ways I've become more giving over time, and in other ways less.
Oh, that's interesting. So prior to writing the book, when you were sort of, you know, falling on your topic or finding your topic, was this like a thing in your vernacular or was it appearing in research? What sort of, you know, led you to this?
There were a lot of experiences that I think ended up pointing in the same direction. I had some really extraordinary mentors who, you know, actually ended up changing my life in multiple ways. And I marveled at the fact that, you know, they were not only really successful but also extremely generous. And I wanted to know, like, how did those two things come to, you know, to go hand in hand? Was it a coincidence? Was it that after people achieve success, they become more generous? And as I started to study it, I found that no, actually, there's a real effect of your early generosity on your later success. I didn't have the language for it at the time, but as I started to read through research, I was struck that this framework of thinking about, you know, people's orientation toward giving, taking, and matching, you know, obviously the takers being the ones who are all about, what can you do for me?
Right.
And the matchers being, you know, most of us who say, you know, when I meet somebody new, you know, it's sort of quid pro quo and I'll play it safe. Those styles showed up in a lot of different parts of our lives. So there were a bunch of experts who were studying them in organizations and how we did that at work. There were separate researchers who are studying our friendships and our family lives and how much giving, taking, and matching we did in those worlds. And I thought it was about time to try to put it all together and make sense of it.
Yeah, we're having Dr. Keltner on the podcast in a few weeks, and his book, The Power Paradox, talks about how often generosity is the thing that gets you to power, but often the downfall in power is when you reverse that. And that can be very difficult in those positions.
I was just with Docker a few weeks ago, and we were talking about what do you do about this paradox?
Right.
Because, you know, in some cases, it really is that, you know, people gain influence and status as they spend more time helping others, right? That's how they prove their competence. It's how they become valued and appreciated. And then, you know, at some point, there are all these people kissing up to them, and, you know, they just become more and more self-focused, and then you end up in the power corrupts trap.
Right.
But I think there's another path that worries me just as much and sometimes more, which is that power, it reveals.
Hmm.
So what I see in some of my research is that when people are at the bottom of a hierarchy, if they're takers, they're really good fakers. When they're managing up, because they know that's how you get ahead, right? You impress people in power with your generosity.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they rise into a position of authority, they realize, you know what, I don't have to fake anymore. I'm in charge.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, now I can become much more unabashed about, you know, just sort of making this all about me. And I think the challenge of identifying, like, who's more of a giver, who's more of a taker before people gain power is something we ought to focus a lot more on.
All these aspects of human behavior are so fascinating, and one of the things I love about your work is you recognize that a great way to transfer this knowledge is through stories, and sometimes you're a figure in those stories. So your new book, Originals, begins with the origin story of Warby Parker, a company that GQ called.
Oh, thanks for reminding me, Kelly.
I know.
I was really hoping you would drag me back into that.
Well, look, man, a great story never is one that works out. No one is like, hey, this. Listen, my good news. That's a terrible story.
Is that why I love improv so much?
Yes, because it's an utter fiasco.
All right, go on.
Yes. So Warby Parker was called the Netflix of eyewear. You guys all know what Warby Parker is. And I mean, like, billions of dollars. And in 2009, because you know the kids who started this, you were pitched to invest in the company.
I was. And I declined. Because how could you order glasses online? You have to go get your eyes checked, and you have to then try them on. And the whole concept just sounded a little bit ridiculous to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I passed on the investment, and now my wife is not happy with me at all.
Right. So you saw what happened. And is that the reason you wrote this book?
It was definitely a part of my motivation.
Uh-huh.
I was struck by the fact that, you know, first of all, there are tons of people who have ideas like that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, the concept for Warby Parker literally, you know, came out of a group of business school classmates who were complaining that, you know, their glasses broke and they had to pay too much to replace them.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, we've had glasses for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years. And why do they still cost more than an iPhone?
Right.
Like, doesn't make any sense. Right.
Nope.
And tons of people have those ideas and they don't act on them.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to know, you know, what holds people back, and how we could get more people championing their original ideas. But then, you know, the other side of that was many times people do, you know, say, look, I'm going to try to make this a reality, and they encounter barriers, which are people like me who stand in the way and say, you know, that's a stupid idea. This
right.
will never work.
Right.
And I came to believe, actually, and yeah, this is right up your alley, that we have a ton of guidance about how to be creative and how to generate new insights and breakthrough directions. What we don't get told is what to do after we have an idea. And so I ended up writing Originals really as a bit of a sequel to creativity to try to make sense of, like, when you have an idea, how do you know if it's any good, right? How could I have recognized the potential in Warby Parker? And then how do you speak up and pitch your idea and then create a whole culture where, you know, people really welcome originality? And I'm going to turn this back around on you for a second.
Okay.
This is part of what you teach people to do. How do you get people to become more effective in pitching their ideas?
Behaviors and environments. So first you have to sort of unlock the shame part of their brain so that they don't, you know, live inside that. But then you have to also recognize what environment am I in that I'm pitching? Because if you're pitching in a boardroom, it's very different than pitching in your bedroom. Your bedroom is the place where it's like your buddy's there, where you can toss out seemingly offensive ideas. And the boardroom is where you've sort of refined that. But it's matched with practice in not giving in to your fear, or better yet, and this is what you start to do, is start to use that fear to sort of drive you. I think that's what it is.
Fascinating. And I have to ask another question on that.
Go ahead.
How do you turn off the shame part of somebody's brain?
The act of improvisation. So we interviewed Dr. Charles Lim, who had put improvisers into MRI scanners. And he actually had to create a plastic piano to work inside the device. And what he studied is when the people were improvising, their brain, the part of their brain that self-censors, goes way down. Interestingly, the part of the brain that controls the English language, that doesn't go up. There's not like more activity there. It's just really about reducing the shame. And so what we find is that when you can give people a strong point of focus, when you can kind of reteach them how to listen, like all the way to the end of a sentence, and have them practice that stuff over and over, it becomes much easier for them to sort of give up the sort of pressure to, you know, be genius in the moment and let instinct take you somewhere. But again, it is always matched with an environment where when you're playing, you can speak truth to power and there's no problems. And those environments change. And I think one of the problems that I always see in people who write books on this stuff is everyone's looking for one way and there is no one way. It's almost always two things in concert with another two things and another two things. And I think that's what you tend to get at when you unwind these stories of these successful endeavors inside originals.
That is a great way to turn the tables back on me.
Thank you.
Well played.
here's how I'm going to do that, because I loved when the Firefox Chrome story, I was like, I told that to everyone to the point that I was annoying people. But I think it's a really interesting discovery that you make. And it comes from Michael Hausman, right? The Economist.
Mike Hausman is presenting at a conference that I helped to organize. And he says, you know, I can predict your job performance and commitment just by knowing what internet browser you use. And we're all like, that's weird. How could that be? And he says, well, if you use Chrome or Firefox, you do better at your job, and you also stick around on average 15% longer than if you're an Internet Explorer or Safari user. And all the Internet Explorer and Safari users, like, they just start to just wither away in their chairs.
Sure.
And we're trying to get to the bottom of this. And at first, Mike and I thought it was a technical advantage,
mm-hmm.
right, that like maybe people who are more computer savvy are going to Chrome and Firefox. And it turns out there's no difference between the different browser groups in computer knowledge or typing speed, and we were able to rule that out. And what we ended up figuring out is that it's really about how you got the browser, that if you use Internet Explorer or Safari, those came pre-installed on your device, and you just accepted the default option that somebody else handed to you. Whereas if you wanted Chrome or Firefox, you had to be a little resourceful and ask, is there something else out there? And then, you know, take the initiative to download this new option. So I'm always worried that when people hear about this research, they're going to be like, so if I want to get better at my job, I just need to download a different browser. No!
No, that's not it.
It's about being the kind of person who has the instinct to question the default, right, and say, I don't want to live in an Internet Explorer world.
Yeah, I love the choice architecture aspect of this and the way it ties into improvisation. In my mind, improv requires that individuals remove their default setting, because when you're improvising, you're not only required to act, you're actually required to discover. And you write something I think that connects to that, which is when we become curious about the dissatisfying defaults in our world, we begin to recognize that most of them have social origins. Rules and systems were created by people, and that awareness gives us the courage to contemplate how we can change them. I mean, it's sort of having a little bit of bravery that the status quo might not be the best thing.
I did write that, didn't I?
Yeah, it's good.
I even believe it.
I believe it.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how many people don't even bother to question the things in the world that drive them crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the ones that do, like we started talking about before, how many of them, you know, just say, look, I'm afraid to speak up. Or, you know, even if fear's not a factor, what holds a lot of people back is just futility.
Yeah.
Saying, you know, I don't think there's going to be a real cost of pitching this idea or speaking up with this thought, but I just don't see a benefit. Like, nobody's going to listen. And so why bother? And a lot of people just give up and censor themselves, which really stifles the amount of original ideas we have in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the pieces that lit up my Facebook feed was your take on child prodigies. I think that probably lit up your social media as well, because you say child prodigies, it turns out, rarely go on to change the world. Why is that?
Well, I think, you know, there are always exceptions to the rule.
Mm-hmm.
But I was struck that the base rate of child prodigy success is really high. But it tends to be conventional success, right? They go on to become really excellent scientists and doctors and mm-hmm. lawyers and teachers. And what you don't see nearly as much as you'd expect is them going on to do something more disruptive and innovative.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what I learned from reading the research on this is that if you're a child prodigy, people marvel at your abilities, and they know that you can master a skill really early and fast. And you basically get encouraged to practice, and you practice over and over again. And what you find is that practice makes perfect, but it doesn't make new.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, these prodigies, like, they can play a beautiful Mozart sonata, but they never wrote their own compositions.
Mm-hmm.
They have figured out the best chess moves to make, but they never thought about inventing the rules of their own game. And I think the earlier that you drill people in sort of internalizing the codified knowledge of a field, the more likely it is that they get into this trap that psychologists call cognitive entrenchment,
mm-hmm.
Where they literally take for granted all these assumptions that need to be questioned, and that makes it harder for them to think creatively and innovatively. And I worry about that effect for, you know, people who are not just prodigies, right, but the deeper you get into expertise in your own industry, the more blind you can become to different ways of solving problems and even new problems that are waiting to be solved.
So this reminds me of a couple of things. Certainly this idea that somehow power and success thwarts your ability to potentially be generous or potentially to innovate even. And I was reminding, and I don't know her full name, it was a Hidden Brain podcast about a woman named Maya who was a child prodigy, I believe violinist, who was studying with Itzhak Perlman, and then she hurt her finger young. And she could not play again. And it happened at a very young age, and ended up, because of that problem, sort of rediscovering, I think it was through like Steven Pinker's work. And she got very into sort of behavioral science. You might know the person I'm talking about. But I feel like it is, while we don't wish discomfort and those sort of deep challenges to our children or to our young people, they're needed throughout life to then, you know, get through and maybe find something sort of original.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's, in a way, this is a great segue to what I've been working on over the last year.
Hmm.
So Sheryl Sandberg and I have a book coming out next month. Actually, you may not want to say next month, depending on when this comes out. So I will.
It'll be next. Yeah, I think you're going to be 50th podcast, so you're coming up in a couple weeks.
Oh, cool. So it'll still be March.
Yep.
Great. So Sheryl Sandberg and I have a book coming out called Option B, which is about facing adversity and building resilience.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it starts with the devastating personal experience that she had of losing her husband, Dave Goldberg, suddenly 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, her trying to figure out, how is she going to get through this? More importantly, how is she going to help her kids through this?
Mm-hmm.
And we were looking for insights. We talked a lot about, you know, what social science had to say. We talked a lot to people who had, you know, really faced extreme hardship and been able to persevere in the face of it. And we did discover that, you know, under some circumstances, there's evidence that people not just bounce back, but bounce forward.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, when they go through extreme hardship, they find a greater sense of personal strength. And they're able to say, you know, the things that used to faze me before, like, now are not a big deal. Like, go ahead, move my cheese, see if I care.
Yeah.
That they, you know, they find appreciation in places they didn't before, that they look for meaning and they see new possibilities they wouldn't have considered when they realize how precious life can be. And I think that, you know, that nobody would wish hardship on anyone.
No.
But I think it happens to all of us. And then, you know, the question is, are you going to find a way to make the most of that experience that you've gone through?
There are so many people in the world of comedy, certainly, and I know firsthand many of them, who experienced significant tragedy in their childhood or growing up. People have been like, well, why, you know, how would they end up in comedy? I'm like, well, how wouldn't they end up in comedy? I mean, you know, there's this idea, and I don't know if this is even a term, but I think I've heard it as post-traumatic growth. Yeah. And I mean, this is Stephen Colbert. This is Tina Fey. And those are happy endings. There's people like Chris Farley, which are bad, terrible endings. And I knew Chris. I mean, I was there through Chris's, you know, just getting out of college and early success, and saw him a couple nights or the night before he died, and was never going to be able to battle those demons. But the other folks have. And those incidents that they went through are defining parts of their personality that they may choose to explore in different ways, some publicly, some not. But I can tell you that they never denied those dark things as part of their narrative. It absolutely was part of their narrative.
That's incredibly powerful. And, you know, it makes me wonder, is the sort of the response there that humor becomes a coping mechanism?
Sure. Yeah.
You know, internally and socially.
Mm-hmm.
And is it just that then people who are already funny, it kind of amplifies how useful that skill is?
Mm-hmm.
Or have you seen cases of people going through, you know, traumatic events and actually discovering comedy?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And I don't know this from a, like, he wasn't funny. Something terrible happened. They become funny. I have no laboratory for that. And I think that would be terrible to do to someone. But I do know a number. I mean, you know, who doesn't have cancer these days, right? And I know people in our community, because we're so closely aligned with Gilda's Club, the cancer support center named after the late, great Gilda Radner, Second City alum. Many of my near and dear friends have taken their cancer stories and found a place to bring them out on stage to hilarious results. And again, now that is so common. And one thing we talk about humor is it's all about recognition. You're recognizing a truth for yourself that maybe you didn't think about in the past. And this is now a truth too many of us share. But in that, my favorite Joni Mitchell line of ever is, laughing and crying, you know it's the same release. I think that's very true. I think people are looking for an emotion, a response, something, and they can cry, and sometimes that's good. Laughter tends to be a little bit better in my book.
I tend to prefer it too. Not sure why.
Yeah, I think we know why. All right, so here's another sort of personal encounter with this book that I had, which is I had to deliver a TEDx in Rochester, Minnesota. And I wasn't really happy with what I had come up with. I had done a previous TEDx in Broadway, which went very well, but I went up on my lines and I had to improvise. Luckily, I know a little bit about that and it was okay, but it wasn't everything I wanted it to be. And I was reading your book and you talked about this idea that procrastination and daydreaming can actually be a source of creativity. So I tried it. I'm not making this up for the interview. I completely did. I put off writing my speech until the week before I had to deliver it, and I never wrote it. I played around with the ideas in my mind the whole time, and it was like a week before. I was practicing in the basement, having trouble with the ending. Went up to my kids, said, like, guys, do you want to walk to Starbucks? They're like, sure. They're like, what are you doing in the basement? And I'm like, I'm practicing my speech. They're like, why don't you give it to us, and we can maybe help you with this ending. And I did. And it worked, and they gave me ideas, and I never wrote a thing down. I just played with it, and these were stories and ideas I knew really well. I just had to kind of figure out how to flow them together. So it was like this idea of procrastinating strategically.
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot to say about that. I'll tell you all of it later.
Okay. Perfect. End of podcast.
I'm so sorry.
No. That was
not
I set that up for you.
You really did. Mm-hmm. I'm grateful for that.
Okay.
Yeah. Look, I don't know that I would want to encourage anyone to procrastinate. I think that, you know, one of the ways, no matter what you do, you end up having your ideas sort of perceived differently than you intend, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ones for me that's been interesting over the past year is people saying, you know, you wrote about how sometimes procrastination, you know, can unlock creativity. Are you encouraging people to procrastinate more? I don't think that most people need to procrastinate more.
No.
Let's
no.
be clear.
We do a lot of it.
I do think that, you know, everybody procrastinates. Some people do it chronically. And I think there's a case to be made that sometimes procrastination is not an expression of laziness or lack of focus. It's, an awareness that you're not there yet. and you haven't figured out how to solve the problem that you're tackling. And if that's the case, that, you know, just normalizing procrastination, right? Saying this is sometimes like an essential part of the creative process, and, you know, it should not drag you down quite as much as it might have before, would that actually make procrastination more of a source of creative insight? Mm-hmm. My hope is that it might.
Yeah. I, for me, it was innovative meditation.
Oh, that's interesting. Meditation. I like that.
Yeah. So in the same, and I don't meditate. My wife does. So I've talked to her about it. And I have a hard time with it because I do the thing I was doing here, which is I have lots of thoughts going on in my mind. It's hard to turn off. But when I was purposeful around this and I was thinking about stories, improv concepts, stories, phraseology, all that stuff, it was very purposeful. And we talk in our work a lot about using failure, that, you know, this idea of sort of mindfully lingering inside a mistake can be a really exciting place to be. And I found that with this as well, that it was a reorienting myself to a thing I was doing anyway and using it more successfully.
I love that. That actually sounds to me much more enjoyable than regular meditation.
Then I will write a book on this.
Done.
I just made a note. All right. I'm going to ask you in a second for a yes and story because we're coming close to the end of our time. But I want to – do you remember our conversation about the woman who gave us that terrible review to our Rush Limbaugh the Musical show?
I do. I love that conversation.
Yes, I remember. I remember it was a good one. So for context, we put on a show called Rush Limbaugh, the Musical. Many people liked it, but a writer named Betty Moore did not enjoy our show. She was a big Rush fan, turns out. So what we ended up doing was taking out an ad in Time Out magazine that only used her terrible quotes about the show. She called it a screaming hate fest, which was one of my favorite things. When I was reading originals, you have a thing about putting your worst foot forward. And there was a quote in there about leading with limitations of an idea makes you look smart. I was sort of wondering, is that the waters you were swimming in when we had that conversation?
Yeah, that's exactly where I was. I was trying to figure out, you know, are there powerful examples of people getting their ideas across by doing the pitch in the exact opposite way that we're all advised to, which is lead with your strength, right? Open with what's most compelling.
Sure.
And I got interested in that actually because the guy in the book, Rufus Griscom, who's this really, really like intriguing serial entrepreneur, he'd watched a talk that I'd given on powerless communication and how, you know, sometimes weak language can actually make you strong. It shows concern for others. It shows that, you know, you haven't fallen in love with your own ideas, that you can look at them in a balanced and, you know, critical way. And I was looking for, you know, some interesting examples to bring that to light. And it turned out Rufus had one of his own. And he had pitched his company by saying, here are the reasons you should not invest in my company. And remarkably, it worked.
Yeah. I mean, this is a thing, right? And it takes a balance because you don't want to live your life by, you know, fronting your mistakes. We interviewed Tina Seelig last week, who I know you're friends with, and she told us that she has her students create failure resumes.
I love these resumes. I was actually just talking about this with a group of students yesterday. I mean, it's remarkable. Every time anybody submits a bio or a resume, all the mistakes they've ever made in their life are scrubbed.
Uh-huh.
And it's this picture of perfection. You've probably seen there was a Princeton professor who put his failure resume online, which went viral. And I love the way he organized it. It was a list of all the graduate school programs that rejected him, all the jobs he applied for that he didn't get, all the grant applications that he submitted that were shot down. And it went on for pages. And if you didn't see that, you would think, like, this guy had never failed in his life. He's extremely accomplished.
Right.
And I would love to see everybody do that.
Yeah. It is so vital because going back to the very beginning part of this conversation, I truly believe the only thing standing between any individual and, quite frankly, their happiness is getting rid of that fear of failure, fear of shame. because we're so conditioned and it's so terrible that we'll do anything, you know, we'll put up any wall in front of it. And what you don't recognize is that, you know, you just have to not care about the wall. And there are techniques to not care about the wall. There's so much potential in drowning and playing with your mistake.
I wish more people understood that.
Me too. Okay, Adam, the podcast is called Getting to Yes And, and what we ask every guest who comes on is, do they have a yes and story, a time in their life or their work where they would normally say no, and they didn't just resort to saying yes, they said yes and. Do you have one of those stories for us?
Yes and.
Perfect.
Do you want me to tell you about it?
Yeah, please do.
All right, sure. So 2011. I think it was about 3 weeks after I found out I got tenure. Mm-hmm. I got an email from Barry Schwartz, who is one of my favorite collaborators. We'd written a paper together. He's probably best known for his book, The Paradox of Choice,
yep.
TED Talk on why freedom can make us unhappy. And he asked if I was interested in writing a book with him. And my instinct in that situation was to say no, because we're not supposed to write books. We're supposed mm-hmm. to publish academic research and, you know, contribute to knowledge. But I had tenure all of a sudden, and that was supposed to give us freedom, especially for those of us who are social scientists, to think about disseminating our ideas more broadly. Like, one of the reasons I ended up choosing to teach in a business school, not just a psychology department, was I really wanted, as an organizational psychologist, to do work that had an impact on people's work lives. And that, helped make work more motivating and meaningful. And so I kind of paused, and I said I was really, first of all, super flattered that he was interested in writing with me. I had no idea that he or anyone else in his shoes would have that interest. Mm-hmm. And secondly, I said, I'd love to discuss further. Like, let's find a time to chat about what you have in mind. And later that week, I went in to meet with my undergraduate students who work in my research lab. And I came in all excited and said, Barry Schwartz invited me to write this book together. And they, one by one, told me not to do it.
Huh.
I was really taken aback.
Yeah.
Such a meaningful opportunity to, build a bridge between the Ivory Tower and Main Street and, mm-hmm. Get these ideas out into the world. And they said, you can't write somebody else's book with them. If you're going to write a book, you should write about your own work and the ideas that you want to put on the table. And I pushed back really hard and said, I think that some of the, I don't even know how to talk about some of the research that I do, outside of, writing for other academics. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that anybody would be interested in what I have to say, or even if they were, would listen to it and agree with it. Mm-hmm. And, they didn't give up, and they insisted that I needed to do it. And I promised them that I would give it serious consideration. And I ended up then knowing that they were going to, I was going to see them a week later, uh-huh. and they were going to ask me, what my book topic was. I spent a bunch of time working on what I would possibly say. And I ended up writing that book, and it was called Give and Take. So here we are.
Your yes and was a yes to a no to a yes and.
Yeah, it was a little bit more of a winding path than intended. But,
no, that's the best.
It became a yes and, because it was a yes to writing a trade book, and the and was that I was going to write a different book.
And how was Barry with the whole thing?
Oh, Barry could not have been more gracious. He wrote back and said, I knew you'd say no, and you should absolutely write your own book, and we should work together again one day, which I cannot wait to do.
Yeah, he yes-anded your no. There's just this is the great thing about all of this, is it's never one
and this
thing.
This is the joy of having a collaborator who's a giver.
Yeah. Right?
Like, he wanted what was best for me and best for the ideas, as opposed to what was best for him. And he probably also knew in the back of his mind that he really didn't need a co-author to write the book that he had in mind, which became Why We Work, which was really excellent.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, Adam Grant, I can't wait to read the book with Cheryl. It sounds heartbreaking and lovely and smart. And thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. A treat as always, Kelly.
Slip down 5 o'clock in the morning. home.